Welcome to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Wednesday, September 20th, 2023. Of course, the website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I participate in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, a contact page, and many other useful and important links. I am on Twitter and Gab at Realist Report, and you can find me on Telegram at t.me/TheRealistReport. I am also a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to and help edit the Barnes Review, a bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all the details. All right, today I am joined once again by John Massaro. All right, John Massaro, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing fine, John.
Good, man.
Glad to be on again.
Yeah, good. Glad you could come back. It's been a while. We've been doing sort of like a travel series. The last program we did, we focused on your travels to China and Vietnam, and then we sort of got into discussing the Vietnam War, and obviously that's a very big topic, one that I really have not studied in any great detail. So I've got a lot of homework to do. I did pick up that book that you mentioned last time you were on by I think the guy's last name is Caputo.
Yeah,
Philip Caputo, A Rumor of War. So I do have that book. I was just mentioning before we started recording that I was kind of just on Wikipedia, kind of looking around at what they had to say about the Vietnam War and about the counterculture movement of the 1960s and some of the developments that took place in this really pivotal period in American history.
It really was. I don't even know. You know, we want to get into the Vietnam War. There's so much. I have so many things jotted down. But,
no, it's fine. Well, this is going to be this will be an ongoing conversation. I mean, we've got about an hour, maybe an hour and 15 minutes or so today, and then we'll pick this up. But I did want to mention that this whole era really needs a revisionist perspective and sort of address this whole situation from a critical, you know, dissident, revisionist type mindset. So that's going to be kind of the goal with this. I know you've already written an article that is quite lengthy dealing with the Vietnam War specifically that I'm planning on it's probably gonna, at some point in the probably early next year will be published in the Barnes Review History Magazine where I'm the assistant editor. So I would encourage people to check out the Barnes Review. It's barnesreview.org and consider subscribing if you're not already. And I've been kind of encouraging you, John, to consider writing something regularly for the Barnes Review, so maybe we can get going with that. But that for that first piece that you submitted is quite good, I'm sure, and it's going to be one of many important contributions to this sort of reassessment of American history. But to get started, I did want to just briefly mention once again that your website is endtheshots.com. I'll have a link over to your website when I post this podcast program. And, of course, you're the author of Will Vaccines Be the End of Us, which you can purchase directly from your website. It's also being sold by the bookstore of American Free Press, and I've written about the book in the past. We've done, you know, numerous shows discussing the history of vaccines and sort of talking about your book, and I'll have links to all of that when I post this podcast program. And I just want to encourage people, if you do not have a copy of this book, Will Vaccines Be the End of Us, you absolutely need to, certainly if you're interested in this topic, because it really is, in my view, like a one-stop shop on the vaccine issue. It's one of the most important books that I've read dealing with this topic. So I wanted to mention that. I wanted to mention your website. Before we get into the main topic, I know you wanted to sort of correct something that you said
in
the last issue. Yeah,
yeah. You know, John, I've listened. You know, when we do these, what is this, about our eighth or ninth
something like that, yeah.
I listen to them, and I'm always very much satisfied. The last one we did 2 months ago, I was talking about China and Vietnam, and I said something, and when I listened to it again, I said, how the hell did I say that? Now, what I said was this. I said, I didn't want to be lugging around a big guidebook of China, so I went to the public library and I ripped some pages out. You know, I never did that. What I vaguely remember was getting a guide, because, you know, the guidebook to China was so big. So what I usually do often, I photocopy a bunch of pages, and that's what I did that time. And I remember there was pages. Somebody else had ripped them out. And I said, I did it. Now, you know, I feel like a total jerk. You know, I've done some things in life that I'm ashamed of, but I'm not a lowlife that goes ripping pages out of library books, okay? So,
no problem. Anyway, thanks for the confession. Yeah, and by the way, let me also just mention this again. This will be our ninth podcast that we've done together over the course of the past year. I think the first podcast we did was sometime late last year. Yeah, it was like November 5th of 2022, so almost a year ago. Okay. So this will be our ninth podcast. We've done quite a few on travel experiences. We've talked about North Korea. We've talked about Africa. We've actually talked about Africa twice. We talked about mine and your personal experiences traveling in America, and just, you know, like maybe like a, we, I know we had a sort of a discussion about the broader American identity. We talked about, traveling in Europe. And then finally we talked about traveling in China and Vietnam. So we've covered a lot of territory, and now we're going to kind of shift gears and talk a little bit about the 1960s, which you lived through, correct? You want to?
Yes, just to get started. You know, and I think most of your listeners were either born in the 60s or born after that, so there's so much they don't remember and or never knew, really.
Or never lived through, yeah.
Yeah, I know. So I just want to talk about, you know, it was an incredible time to live through, good and bad. I mean, it was such a, as you said earlier, it was such a transforming decade. So I want to talk about that. You know, the first thing I want to do, though, you know, I was born in November of 53. So I was, you know, when the calendar flipped over to 1960, I was just 6 years old. So I don't remember. I honestly, for example, I don't remember anything about President Eisenhower. Don't remember anything about him. But there was a lot going on in the 50s and the early 60s that I really didn't, as I was growing up. Well, I'll get into when I started becoming conscious of things getting a little strange and pretty scary. But I just want to give some background. You know, everybody talks about the 1950s being a very complacent decade. It was like, a time when it was like the golden age of America, like nothing was happening really. But, you know, there was a lot going on, and it really going back 100 years, really going back to probably even the late 19th century. I want to read a quote from J. Edgar Hoover, and he was a despicable guy. He's certainly not a hero of mine. But every once in a while, you know, some of these people that we don't like, they say something that's pretty perceptive. This is a quote. This was printed in a magazine called Elks Magazine, August 1956. And of course, you know, before that we had the McCarthy era, when he did his best to smoke out communists in government. And of course, the press just destroyed him. But this is what J. Edgar Hoover wrote in August of 1956. And of course, he's talking about communism. He said, "The individual is handicapped by coming face to face with a conspiracy so monstrous he cannot believe it exists. The American mind simply has not come to a realization of the evil which has been introduced into our midst. It rejects even the assumption that human creatures could espouse a philosophy which must ultimately destroy all that is good and decent." You know, we see that happening right now, and yet the seeds were planted back. Well, as I said, they were planted, you know, more than 100 years ago, but this was really among the more aware people in the 1950s. It was happening then, too. And then you had the Hungarian Revolution just 2 months later. By the way, have you ever read David Irving's book, Uprising?
No, I have not. Is that like the nationalist uprising in Hungary?
Yeah, and it was very, very ferocious. It was, and we did nothing to help those people. You know what was different about Irving's book is that he mentioned the whole Jewish role of communism in Hungary. And I remember him saying, I listened to one of his speeches once, and he said it was more an anti-Jewish uprising than an anti-communist uprising. And of course, that was the first. Right. I had read a couple of books about the Hungarian Revolution before that, but that was the first time I read that. And, you know, then in 1958.
I mean, the Jewish role in communism is extremely well documented by a variety of sources, including the federal government itself of the United States and multiple other Western governments. I mean, this was very, very well known. And that quote, I want to just also briefly comment on that quote from Hoover, who I agree with you, he was a totally – despicable individual. But yeah, that quote is quite spot on, quite perceptive.
Yeah.
And yeah, and this is something that I didn't realize the extent of it. I mean, I sort of like had heard about it, you know, how communists had like infiltrated the government going back to even the FDR administration and probably even before that. I mean, 1913, I think, was a pivotal year in American history with the establishment
absolutely.
Of the Federal Reserve. The ADL came into existence then.
Yeah,
the income tax, the way senators were elected was changed. So there's
and the
a
Federal Reserve, too.
And the Federal Reserve was established in 1913.
Yeah,
so there's a lot going on that year. But I remember reading a book, and maybe you've read it as well. It's called Stalin's Secret Agents, The Subversion of Roosevelt's Government by M. Stanton Evans and Herbert Romerstein.
No, I don't. I've read another book about the people under the guys on the, I forget the title of it right now, but not that one. You know.
Okay, it's very, very good. Yeah, it's very, very good. I read it years ago. And I think I'm pretty sure it's M. Stanton Evans was one of the big reporters that broke all the Venona transcripts or the Venona secrets.
That name rings a bell. He used to write for Human Events, which is like a really weak tea conservative, which I started reading, you know, back in the 70s before I became aware of everything behind the scenes. Yeah,
I know he's done a lot of good work. This book in particular is outstanding. He also wrote a book called Blacklisted by History, The Untold Story of Senator Joe McCarthy and His Fight Against America's Enemies. So he did expose a lot of very important and hidden aspects of American history, namely the total infiltration of the federal government by communist agents working directly for Stalin and the Soviet Union. And this is extremely, again, well-documented, even by by our own federal government. I mean, a lot of this information was kept hidden for a very, very long time. But basically, by the time Roosevelt came into power, I mean, his entire administration was riddled with communist agents and communist sympathizers. Many, of course, were, in fact, Jewish. Henry Morgenthau comes to mind, and there's a number of others that were deeply involved at the highest levels of his administration, particularly during World War II. And, of course, these are some of the individuals that implemented the policies in the post-war era to basically genocide the German people and really just, you know, create this monolithic globalist one world order dominated by the Jews running the United States and Western Europe and all these other globalist type institutions. So I just wanted to mention that. I mean, I basically look at the U.S. federal government and the media and academia and pretty much most important institutions in society as more or less being subservient to, largely anyways, international Jewry, even before World War II started. You know, I mean,
yes, absolutely.
So that's something that we need to keep in mind. And it's only gotten worse since then, obviously.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. But, you know, I was unaware of all this stuff. Like I said, especially in the 50s, I have very few memories. I know the John Birch Society was established in December of 1958. You know, and they were, you know, a very well-known anti-communist organization, although they would refuse to name the Jew. And you know, they're still around. I can't even believe it. I mean, I don't know how many people take them seriously anymore. I couldn't even believe they're still in existence. But then they had Castro coming to power in Cuba in January of 1959. You know, and for a couple of years, everybody, you know, nobody could believe that he was a communist. He went on the Ed Sullivan Show, I think, in maybe even before he came to power. I don't know. And it wasn't really till a couple of years that people started realizing, you know, hey, this guy is totally backed up by the Soviet Union. And you know, it's funny. We, you know, we talk about the way people are so brain dead today, but yet it was the same back then. I jotted down a quote that I read somewhere from Revelo Oliver. You know, really, really great mind. And I think this is either 1960 or 61. He said the American people remind him of, and this is a quote, the cattle one sees peering between the slats of large trucks, contentedly munching hay on their way to the abattoir, to the slaughterhouse. In other words, they just don't know what the hell is going on. They're just totally out of it. And I think, you know, this is like more than 60 years ago. And it kind of describes people today, too. I mean, nothing much has changed in that regard. But
Well, and you know what? I think the biggest problem is like that's sort of like the nature of the masses, right? I mean,
it is.
they're meant to be led, they're meant to be directed. And the problem is that the more noble people of our race have been systematically eliminated from public life. I mean, you pretty much have to be compromised or blackmailed or just a total puppet or stooge to even get anywhere in politics these days. You know what I mean?
That's
And that's
so true.
something, again, that we saw reflected all throughout this era in particular. I mean, they took out Kennedy. They took out numerous people. George Lincoln Rockwell was taken out. I mean, they pretty much systematically either purged or outright murdered or marginalized or bankrupted pretty much all of the key individuals that were standing in their way that actually had a sense of virtue and honesty and dignity, right? I mean,
Yeah,
that's a
thank
key theme of this whole era, I think, that is often overlooked is,
Yeah.
yeah, so anyways.
So let me just get back. So 1960, I do remember the election. I was almost 7 years old, and I was born late November 53. I was almost seven, and I do remember the election. I remember the buzz on the school playground, and that was kind of exciting, even though I knew nothing about it. But let's get into 1961 now, and the things I'm going to talk about. This is how big. I don't remember any of these things I'm going to mention in 61, and but there was, communism. This was like spreading around the world. In 1961, actually, just to go back a little bit, 1960, the Belgian Congo received its independence from Belgium, and the whole place just went. It was just total anarchy, total savagery, just overnight in the summer of 1960. And in 61, there was, and the United Nations was very much a part of this. Just like spreading all this communist propaganda, anti-white stuff. In 61, there was a small army based in the Congo, and they crossed the border into Angola. This is in March of 61. And it was a very isolated area of Angola, very poor communications. Angola was a Portuguese colony back then. And in 3 days, they murdered, pretty much hacked to pieces, like 1,000 Portuguese settlers. And this was almost completely censored by the global media, except in Portugal. It was very well known there. And as a matter of fact, there's a book written about it. It was published 4 years later, "The Fabric of Terror," by Bernardo Teixeira, and it has some pretty gruesome photographs in it. And it's a really, if you want to know what was kind of going on, especially in Africa back then, I highly recommend this book. It was like, a few people did survive by hiding, and it was their like eyewitness accounts. So it's a very, very searing book. But I didn't, of course, I didn't know anything about that at the time. I was only seven. Then the next month we had the Bay of Pigs, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, right?
Right. That was the CIA operation in Cuba.
The whole story, I don't even know the whole. They were going to overthrow Castro. And then when we landed, there were about 1,500 anti-Castro Cubans that were ready to do the job, and we just left them stranded on the beach. That was a big. I don't even know the full truth about that, but it was a huge issue at the time.
And that was
So,
and that was when Kennedy was like, "Look, I'm gonna splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces." Was after that because
he said that.
I think that whole operation was kind of done behind his back, right?
Maybe, I don't know. I've read conflicting accounts about it. I don't know if he chickened out or if it was just planned very foolishly. But the bottom line is we left those people on the beach. We just stranded them there. 1,500 anti-Castro, anti-communist Cubans, and I don't even know what happened to them. I don't know if they were executed or imprisoned or whatever. But it was really quite a betrayal. So then that was in April of 61. Then in August, the Berlin Wall went up, which was huge news at the time. Of course, again, I don't have any recollection of that. Then in the very next month, when the Congo went nuts, there was a province called Katanga in the south that seceded, and it was led by a very a guy an African leader named Moise Tshombe. Who was a very admirable guy, very pro-West, very anti-communist, and after they actually seceded, like 2 weeks after the Congo got its independence, because everything was just going crazy. You know, whites were fleeing for their lives. There's cannibalism, savagery. So he seceded, and he was completely backed by the pro-West, by everybody who knew what was going on in Europe, especially in Belgium. He was on our side. He was a very good guy. And what happened was, as soon as they seceded, the United Nations took a very dim view of that, as did Kennedy. In September of 61, United Nations, like a multinational United Nations army, just went in there and made war in that province to force them to fall back in line under the central government. And it was like full-blown war for a couple of months. And this went on for on and off for about 16 months. And I remember there was a full-page ad in December of, I think it was December of 61, that I don't think very much of Buckley, but I think he took it out, whatever his group was, just condemning the whole UN operation and saying, what's the matter with us? What's the matter with us Americans? We've just gone
Buckley,
crazy, you know?
Yeah, Buckley was National Review, right?
Yeah.
William Buckley, yeah.
Anyway, that started in 61 as well, and I don't have any recollection of that. I'll tell you what I do remember. In 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis, that was October of 62. I was in the fourth grade. I do remember, I still remember this on the playground. You know, we were in fourth grade, and there was a guy named Warren Schmidt. He was a sixth grader. He was explaining the whole thing to us. There was a lot of, I don't know, for some, I just absorbed all the tension in the air because supposedly, I don't know if it was true or not, but supposedly we were on the brink of nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And it was just a very scary experience. I do remember that. I remember also in the early 60s, they would have these drills in my elementary school. Did you ever hear about this? Kids ducking under desks.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I've seen the videos of it. Yeah. The whole like the public service announcements about, yeah.
Never saw a video of that, but I remember going through it.
Get under your desk. I mean, assuming I don't know if you know this, but I'm actually kind of skeptical of the concept of nuclear weapons. But assuming they are real, I mean, if you're going to get under your desk, what's that going to do?
I know, you know.
Anyways, I don't even want to get onto that subject, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, anyway, so and then in 62, again, I don't remember too much. I do remember a little bit all the trouble in the South. We talked about this just before we went on. I went on Wikipedia yesterday, and I didn't realize how I knew about some. I knew about a lot of it, but not all of it. But in Alabama, especially in Alabama and Mississippi, this is like the heart of the so-called civil rights movement, and it was basically an attempted communist revolution in the South. It was, it was like a replay of an attempt at Reconstruction. You know, which, of course, that horrible period after the Civil War. So. There was a lot of stuff going on. What happened in I was telling you before we went on that Kennedy sent 30,000 federal troops. There was a guy named James Meredith who tried to enroll in the University of Mississippi in Oxford, and there was a lot of violence. He sent, as a matter of fact, two of the whites down there got killed. It was almost like open warfare. And another thing that Robert Kennedy, who is John's Attorney General, there was a retired general named Edwin Walker. Did you ever hear about this episode?
Keep going. Maybe I'm not.
Okay, he was like a retired general, very conservative, and he went down there and he gave a speech. And I don't know the substance of the speech. Everything, it wasn't. He wasn't like he wasn't provoking violence or anything like that, as far as I know. But Robert Kennedy had him arrested by federal marshals at that time. This is like October. This is right before the Cuban Missile Crisis, a couple of weeks earlier. He had him arrested and committed to a mental institution for psychiatric examination. This is Robert now, who in my mind was a real scumbag, really worthless, really a real turd. And there was such an outcry at the time that he was sent to they had psychiatric hospital, federal psychiatric hospital in Springfield, Missouri. You must be familiar with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there was such an outcry against that they had to release him. So, you know, this was going on in 62. And then, of course, there was the famous scene with George Wallace, who was the governor of Alabama, standing in the doorway. I don't remember that at the time that it happened, but you must be familiar with that, right? I would guess.
Yeah, George Wallace. I don't recall exactly when that happened, but yeah, no,
it was,
he run? He ran in the 64 election, right, for president?
68 and 72 is the third.
Oh,
party
okay,
it's
a little bit later. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing I wanted to comment on. Speaking of the 1960 election, it was extremely, extremely contested.
Very close.
Yeah, Kennedy only beat Nixon by like 100,000 votes. I mean, it was like nothing.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the electoral map right now. So, anyways, yeah, it was a Kennedy barely got into office, and then of course he was assassinated 3 years later. Mm-hmm. Lyndon Johnson comes in, and then so I was thinking that Wallace was even earlier than 68, but anyways, needless to say that there were a lot of upheavals taking place. Not only in America, especially in the South, but around the world in Africa, as you're mentioning, in Europe. So there's a lot going on in this period of history.
Yeah, especially that decade, there were a lot of assassinations. John Kennedy, then Malcolm X. I remember that. That was in February of '65. He was a big
black nationalist. Yeah.
Black nationalist, exactly. And he wasn't. He said a lot of pretty interesting things. He was kind of like Louis Farrakhan of his time. Not really. I wouldn't call him an evil guy, but anyway, he was assassinated in 65. I remember that. Then in South Africa, Hendrik Verwoerd, who was a great man, he was assassinated in 66. I don't remember that at all. And Rockwell in 67. The thing was, I had never heard of Rockwell. I was 13 years old at the time, and but I do remember the newspapers reporting his assassination. I said, "Who is this guy?" And of course, they made him out to be an evil. It was very kind of subtle. He had been shot dead, but I didn't know anything about him at the time. And then, of course, in '68, you had, which I very well do remember, was Martin Luther King in April of '68, then Robert Kennedy in June, two months later. So there were a lot of assassinations.
Lots of trauma. Yeah,
lots of major traumatic
events taking place. Yeah.
Yeah, and I will tell you, I do one thing I definitely do remember, like it was yesterday, was when John Kennedy was assassinated. I was in the fifth grade then. I still remember this very, very clearly. We had like an old maid teacher, Miss Schneider, and there was a little old-fashioned phone that hung on a hook beneath the blackboard, and had a direct line to the principal's office. And every once in a while, it would buzz with some kind of routine message. Gym class canceled or an upcoming field trip. So it buzzed that day. It was just a Friday afternoon. It was about 2 o'clock. All us kids were looking forward to going home for the weekend, then Thanksgiving coming up. And it buzzed. And right away we knew, she said, "Oh my God. Oh dear God." And she was like, her voice was kind of shaky, And we all knew something was wrong, So she hung up the phone and then she just turned around. She said, "Please, everyone, just be quiet and pay attention. I have some terrible news." Then she just paused for a few seconds just to compose herself. Then she just said, "President Kennedy was assassinated." And it was, it was just one of those moments in life that you never forget. Just like you remember where you were with 9/11. I'm sure you remember what you were doing and where you were. That I remember that so clearly.
I was in school. I was in I was in my marketing class in high school. I was a sophomore in high school, I think. Yep, I remember it exactly.
Okay. And it was really traumatic. Nobody in our classroom cried, but I later heard that there was other teachers and other students, in our elementary school that just started crying when they heard the news. And
I can imagine. Yeah, it's
yeah.
Very,
and
yeah.
I remember watching standing with my parents. In front of the television set 3 days later, watching a funeral on television, and tears were just running down my mother's face. No words were spoken. It was a very, very emotional thing. It was like 9/11. It was so traumatic.
Were they? And, was your family? Were they Democrats? Did they vote for Kennedy?
No, they were like Republic. Very mushy. I would say very mushy conservatives. Very wishy washy, but basically conservative.
Still, even though they didn't necessarily support Kennedy, this had a very market
yeah,
impact
I mean,
on them. Yeah.
Everybody, you know, everybody looking back, everybody I knew at the time either liked or loved President Kennedy. You know, he was handsome. He was charismatic. You know, I didn't know these other bad things about him, and I'm going to go into that in a minute, but he was very, very, you know, and all us kids looked up to him. You know, there really hasn't been another president like that. Maybe Reagan a little bit, but there was just something about his charisma. You know, he just, and even for months after his assassination, I remember seeing his photograph. You know, a lot of people put them up in their houses. Of course, in the post office, I remember. You know, it just, that kind of lingered on, you know. Of course, later when I got older, I realized there was another side to him. You know, he was kind of a very, I would say of all the presidents of my lifetime, I guess 13 or 14, he was a pretty interesting guy because there were some good things. As I'm sure you know, he really tried to prevent Israel from getting nuclear weapons. And he had a very bad relationship with Ben Gurion, who was the prime minister of Israel back then. You know, and back in, he said some very positive things about Hitler. I think this was going back to the late 40s or 50s, if I remember. Are you familiar
yeah,
with that?
And, yeah, in his diary.
Yeah, he said something.
Yeah, I think
say he didn't come right out and admire him, but he said, after a while, all these negative feelings about Hitler are going to pass because of all the things he did for his country. He said he had the stuff of legends in him. I think that those were his words. So, you know,
yes,
no other president has ever said anything like that. And then, as you said earlier, he wanted to abolish the CIA. Then, also, you must know about Operation Northwoods, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Whatever his position
was, Lyman Limitzer, he wanted to, like, shoot down American airplanes and blame it on Cuba. All those kind of things. He wanted to do all these kind of crazy things. And this is what I read anyway. When Kennedy heard that, he was outraged. And I think he fired him or he demoted him. He just couldn't believe anybody would say something like that. But then on the other hand, he was, you know, I read later, you know, the people who were like genuine patriots at the time, they considered him a traitor. And for good reason, you know, he did a lot of, you know, just the things he did in the South. He really pushed the civil rights movement. And what was also interesting was, and he also completely backed the, what I mentioned earlier, that the war against Katanga, which was led by a very pro-Western native leader. And he kicked in a lot of his own slush fund money to back. Because that was like the United Nations' first really big test. And, you know, they failed it in flying colors. And they actually went bankrupt over it, or close to bankrupt. And he kicked in a lot of his own, what they call his slush fund, and he totally backed that. And even when he was a state senator in the 1950s, he supported a lot of these African liberation movements, you know, which were completely backed by international communism. So
yes, yeah, wow.
So he was very, and another thing. This is kind of like gossipy stuff, but it's also very interesting. You know, he had an affair with Marilyn Monroe. That's very well, and his brother did as well, Robert, which is kind of, you know, he cheated on his wife, on Jackie, a lot. Kind of, you know, just a lot of these guys do, but it was very well known at the time. As a matter of fact, there's a YouTube, I've seen it a couple of times. Marilyn Monroe sang Happy Birthday to him in 1962. This is May of 1962. Really sensually. It was like a fundraiser for him in New York City.
Mm-hmm. Like I remember the video, yeah.
Oh, you've seen that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a very famous video, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you've seen that. Well, what I wanted to mention, like just in passing, was that I, you know, just about a month ago, I came across a little item. This is a very interesting story. There's a book out. It's called Bombshell, The Night Bobby Kennedy Killed Marilyn Monroe. I didn't read the book, but I read an article about it. And it's very well documented that the night before her death, he visited her with his brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, who was a Hollywood actor. And he was livid because she felt like she was used by by him and John. So she had threatened to reveal, you know, to spill all the beans about their affair. including all the intimate details in bed and everything. And he was livid, and he insisted, and she had said that this was in her diary, and he went to her home in outside of Los Angeles. This is August of 62. And, he wanted her diary, and it was a real bad scene. Peter Lawford was there, and he, I think he threw her to the ground, and then he said something like, he snuck some a poison into her drink. He said, just drink this. You need to calm down. And he killed. Basically, he killed her. This is the story, and I do believe it sounds credible. I know there's all kinds of sensationalist stories. And the funny thing was, the guy who wrote this book, he bumped into Peter Lawford, who is like 20 years later after this happened. And he said he was just, it always haunted him. And he looked like a wreck. He couldn't face himself after that night. So this is the kind of person that Bobby Kennedy was. And I do believe that. I would bet $1,000 that that actually did happen. So you don't
have a very positive opinion of Bobby Kennedy, especially, but even JFK.
Yeah. The funny thing is, now Robert Kennedy Jr., I think, is not – Robert Kennedy was an evil bastard. No question about that in my mind. Just a real low life. Well, he's a murderer. A cold-blooded murderer as far as I'm concerned. And then what he did committing General Walker to a mental institution, I mean, that just shows you what kind of person he was. Yet, he was very – as a little kid, he was a very, very handsome guy, very – like his brother, like his older brother, who I don't think was as evil as him. Very charismatic and, was part of the Kennedy mystique of the 60s. And, you always – through the 60s, you always heard something about the Kennedys. They were very – they were the family. What I was going to say earlier was I think Robert Kennedy Jr. has a lot of the characteristics of his uncle. I think he's a very mixed bag. I don't want to get off on that tangent here. I mean, there are some good things you could say about him, but some really negative things too, if you really want to go into his background.
I'm pretty skeptical of him, honestly. Although, I mean, he has said some interesting things, which I think are positive, but yeah.
Yeah. Now, I want to say 1964, so that was 63, and of course, I remember the hearing about his President Kennedy's assassination. It was, I still remember that very vividly, almost 60 years later. Now, 1964, this is the first, I'm curious about the world, but I didn't really read the papers that much or watch TV news too much. But I do remember in 64, there was the World's Fair was in New York City that year. Actually, it was in Queens, and it was only about 15 miles from my home. I lived about 20 miles east of Manhattan, a little town called Williston Park. And there was a lot of, there were things going on, bad race things around the country, like kind of under the radar, not as bad as what would happen later in the decade. But I do remember there was a lot of trouble, a lot of racial protests, people getting arrested at the World's Fair. And I remember getting a little nervous about that, because it was really quite close to home. And it was, I remember that. That was my first inkling of race problems, really real race problems. And then the first time, I remember this also very well, in the summer of 64, you must know the names Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman and James Chaney,
yeah,
the three civil rights murders. This is the first time. Okay, and they were two New York Jews, Schwerner and Goodman, and they were kind of the they were part of the whole Northern invasion of the South. The so-called Freedom Riders.
The Freedom Riders, yeah, I was gonna say, weren't they involved in that? Yeah.
Yeah, and I at the time, of course, I was being subtly brainwashed. They were really good people. Going down, and I read, years later, I read To Kill a Mockingbird in school, which really totally brainwashed me. But 64, when they first disappeared, like I think in June of 64, and I still remember in Newsday reading the article and seeing the picture of them, and there was it was like an FBI wanted bulletin, and it was said something like missing. And I could still remember the brainwashing of thinking, these really three fine young men, what happened to them, you know, what happened to them at the hands of these evil Southerners, you know, these Ku Klux Klan guys and all that stuff. Then, of course, a few weeks later, their dead bodies were discovered. They were buried. And that was like one of the biggest news items of 64. But again, that was significant for me because that was the first time I remember being subtly brainwashed by the media. And then, of course, the Brainwashing New Generation. They came out with the movie Mississippi Burning, I think, in 1989. Of course, I didn't see it. I knew the score by then, but that was based on their murder. And of course, it was all a bunch of nonsense. And I later learned, I later read an interesting book by an FBI informant named Delmar Dennis, who was really kind of a traitor. But he gave the whole story about, he was from Mississippi. He was a pastor. And he was really outraged by all these people from the North coming down and raising hell and inciting racial hatred of the blacks against the whites. But he claims to be against violence, too. So he became an informant for the FBI, and so he kind of gave the whole story. And he said Schwerner was a really obnoxious son of a bitch. Actually, he telephoned him because he had infiltrated the Klan, and he knew that they really hate, especially Schwerner. I think the other two were in the wrong place at the wrong time with Schwerner when they were murdered. But he picked up the phone. And he actually called Schwerner, even though he hated him. He said, listen, he said, your life is in danger. You better get out of the state. And Schwerner made some really obnoxious remark, and he hung up on him. And but he should have heeded that warning and left the state because, he ended up being taken out of a car and staring down the barrel of a shotgun, and it was the last thing he ever saw. So that was huge in 64. And then, of course, in 65, and I kind of remember this, the Watts riot in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that, or have you?
I mean, I don't remember. I was born in 86. Yeah, definitely. I'm familiar with it. And you know what? Even all of these instances back then, like these big riots, like the Watts riot, for example, it was, again, like it's like the same story just repeating itself in the modern day. It's like these criminal blacks like commit a crime and then the cops get involved and next thing you know there's riots and there's protests and it's like the same story over and over. Yeah,
I mean there's a lot of stuff going on again under the a lot of really bad confrontations in the South, but the police were pretty there were no really even right through the 60s there were no huge really bad riots like with arson and looting. It just didn't happen in the South. Even right through the 60s, because it was very, the police were very no-nonsense, and, once these things started flaring up, they just put them down. I don't mean killing people, but pretty brutal beatings, that sort of thing. But the Watts riot was really the first big one where they just burned down, block after block. I mean, buildings were just burned to the ground. And they brought in the National Guard. There were, a lot of military vehicles rolling. I was just watching the old newsreels yesterday on YouTube, just to as a little refresher course. Yeah, I mean, it was huge. I mean, you see the military, and then you see soldiers marching with bayonets, the weaponized National Guard. I mean, it was pretty wild. And the funny thing, well, it's not funny, but this happened like 1 week after the Johnson passed the Voting Rights Act. One week later, it's supposedly, we're turning a new page in racial relations. Of course, the Civil Rights Act was passed the year before in 64. And but then the Voting Rights Act came along in 65, and this happened like right on the heels of that. Another thing I want to say about Johnson, I know a lot about him now. He was a real – I don't know if you've ever looked into his background. He was a real beast. He was one of the crudest from what I've read, I don't know how true it is, but when he was a state senator in Texas, he had people killed that were in his way. The story goes he had his own sister killed. I don't know if that's true. But, I've read a lot of things about him. He was a really foul-mouthed, crude bastard. And a lot of people, when he became president – You know, a lot of senators and congressmen were very intimidated by him. And he was a big guy. He was like 6'4", and he would just stare people down if they like opposed any of his anything that he wanted passed. And you know, a lot of stories about him. He would urinate on the White House lawn when, in front of guests. You know, this kind of thing.
And I've heard a lot of those same stories. Dr. Jim Fetzer, who has written a lot about the JFK assassination and Lyndon's role in it and that sort of thing. I've learned a lot from him over the years about about the JFK assassination in general, but definitely about Lyndon Johnson. There's a guy named Philip Nelson that's written quite a bit about Lyndon Johnson as well. Mm-hmm. I think his main argument is that Lyndon Johnson like played one of the key roles in setting up the entire assassination, which would not surprise me.
No, I've read that too. In fact, I saw it. I read an interview by somebody who knew him very well, a woman, and she was afraid to. She said that he said something to him. She said something before the day before the assassination. Because he really couldn't stand the Kennedys. You probably know that.
Yeah,
especially
exactly.
Bobby Kennedy. They hated each other's guts. And he said something like, "After tomorrow, the Kennedys will never embarrass me again," or something like that. So apparently, you know, I don't know how true all this stuff is, but you know, sounds credible to me. So
you know, can I ask you? Sorry to interrupt you. I just want to ask before we get too far off the topic. You had said how you know you were what 10 years old when Kennedy was killed, something like that.
Just before my 10th birthday.
Just before your 10th birthday. And then, so I'm curious, I guess it's a two-part question. When did you start, like, questioning the official, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald lone gunman absurd narrative? And also, what are your main takeaways after researching the Kennedy assassination? Is there any particular books or sources that have been influential on your thinking?
I'll tell you something funny, John. There's so much. The first part of your question, when did I would say in the late 70s was when I started becoming, after I graduated college, or, you know, I had a really interesting college professor who had a really, you know, I went to Adelphi University, which was just totally a joke, just like all colleges are, really leftist. But I did have one really good, I majored in philosophy and history, and I had one philosophy teacher who really had an influence on my life. He was very conservative, which was an oddity back then. And he was like a pro-Israel conservative type, but he got me interested in these issues. And he kind of introduced me to really good books. And so that's when I really started reading, was in the late 70s. But, you know, I've got to tell you, this is going to sound kind of strange. There are so many, I think the Kennedy assassination holds a record for the number of books that have been published about it. And, I said to myself, you know, there's so many conflicting accounts. How can I ever get down to the truth? I mean, I have a fair idea of what happened or some of the facts, but it really never interested, for some strange reason, it never interested me as much as, like, books about World War II. I think I only read two books about it. I read Michael Collins Piper's book, Final Judgment, and I read what was the other one by Mark Lane? Was it Rush to Judgment?
He wrote Rush to Judgment. I think he wrote a couple books about the Kennedy assassination.
You know, you hear about the mafia, or then Castro was, you know, so many different interpretations. I you know, I'm pretty well satisfied in my own mind that Israel had a hand in it. And a lot of people in we call it the deep state now, especially the CIA, they wanted him dead. And yeah, so
Lane wrote Rush to Judgment and then Plausible Denial, which were both.
Plausible Denial, that's the one I read, Plausible Denial, yeah, okay. And then I read Michael. Even Michael, as great an author as he was, there was something about that book. I mean, it opened my eyes to a lot of things, but there were so many loose ends. There was so much speculation that after I got done reading it, I was kind of dissatisfied. I said, you know what, nothing is really nailed down. But that's not his fault. I mean, but there were just, like I said, so many open ends that were really, like, for example, we know almost exactly what happened when the Israelis attacked the Liberty. We know that was done in cold blood. I mean, but nothing like that about the Kennedy assassination that that impressed me that way.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think part of the problem is not only just the massive government secrecy and, you know, they've concealed all these documents for so many years.
Okay, Jim. Sorry about that, John.
No, it's okay. I think, yeah, that's part of the problem is the government is like hidden so many records and falsified and fabricated so much evidence, and you know, they've just thrown a million different pieces of disinformation and just outright fake
Yeah.
evidence. And you know, I mean, from the films, I mean, the Zapruder film was altered, the X-rays were altered. I mean, there's so many shenanigans that went on with this entire case. It's really tough to get to the bottom of things.
Yeah,
I
that's
think, I
true.
mean, yeah, I've kind of, I mean, I'm interested in the subject. Although in recent years, I kind of really haven't focused too much attention on it. I still think it's an important issue, obviously, but getting down to like the nitty-gritty details of exactly what happened is sort of
I
missing
don't
the
think we're.
mark, I think, at this point. It's like, look, who benefited from this? What was it all about? And it's, of
And
course,
we're never
that.
going to know the full truth. That's the thing. I
Yeah.
mean, it's just because another thing is so many people that were involved are dead. In fact, probably all of them are dead now.
Well, and not
So, you
only
know.
that, but so many people involved were making things up and telling outlandish
Yeah.
stories, and then, you know, you're spending all your time investigating what they're alleging, and it's not even true half the time. So, yeah, they just threw a million different loose ends into it. And, you know, they've created this entire, which, I mean, you know, I think is worth doing. I mean, you want to try to figure out what the hell happened. You got to get into the weeds and all these issues. But it's at this point, I think it's sort of just a, and I don't want to say necessarily a waste of time. I just, there's so many other issues to look into, you know?
Right. You know, another thing I
So,
wanted to say
anyways, I
about
was just curious
Johnson.
about Kennedy. Yeah.
Well, that's my answer. I just it just it doesn't interest me the way it should really, because it was such a big part of my childhood. But you know, I just wanted to mention this about Johnson too. He was president when I was 10, when I was 10 to 15. So I remember. I certainly remember him. But the one thing that stands out, and this just goes to show how the media. Again, I wasn't really following the news that much. I was just like a young teenager, a boy growing into a young teenager. The one thing that I remember, this is going to sound ridiculous, but the one news item I remember, and it was such a big thing for a couple of days, was the way everybody's making a stink because I think he had one or two pet beagles, and it was an issue, and he would lift them up by the ears. And that's the one thing that stands out in my mind about him. That just shows how, even back then, the media would just get hooked on these little trivial issues. But that I remember that. For some reason, I remember that, the way he would pick up his dogs.
What kind of cruel thing is that to do to a dog? That reveals a lot about a person.
It does. I think it was by the ears. Maybe you could just check that out. But I think, yeah. Well, but of course, it didn't hit me at the time that that's. He was being cruel. I thought, maybe he had his own opinion about things. I don't know. I'm just a kid, okay?
Yeah,
I didn't.
I just
Yeah.
Googled it right here. Yeah.
Did he pick
Nope.
him up by the ears?
Yeah,
Is it that? Yeah.
lifted up his beagle in 1964 in front of reporters.
Oh, okay.
And enraging animal lovers and animal rights groups. But who would do
That's
that?
funny.
I mean, that's terrible. I mean.
It is terrible. Picking up. Yeah. But that stands out in my mind as the one news item about him, while he was doing all kinds of horrible things. I mean,
He
the way this
definitely
was.
was a major. Yeah, just to pick up where we got kind of cut off right there, I was just saying Johnson truly was, at least from what I've been able to gather, you know, reading about him and you know, getting to know more about him, just a total scumbag, a major
He was.
thug, a bully, and frankly, an outright criminal. I mean, you talked about he had like his own hitman. I mean, he was a really, really monstrous
He's one of the
person.
worst.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
He
anyways,
was a monster. He was.
we can move on from LBJ, but I just wanted to finish that thought. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. You know what? But there's, and then for me, I got to say, I mean, I was oblivious to a lot of this stuff. For me personally, 1967 was like a turning point. That's when I kind of sensed. I mean, there was a lot of degeneracy going on, like under, behind the scenes that I really didn't pick up on. But 67 was kind of a turning point. That's when I kind of this is when the hippies are coming into play now, and then drugs and all kinds of sexual weirdness. And I just kind of sensed social norms breaking down around that time, 67. But before that, it was really, I jotted down a lot of notes about really good things about the 60s. But, you know, I also wanted to mention, you know, Johnson, he passed, I think it was him. Yeah, it must have been him that passed the Gun Control Act of 68. And I just want to mention this offhand. You know, I looked into this once, and there was, as far as I can see, going all the way back to colonial times, there was only one. There was only two mass shootings, which happen all the time now. You know, I'm talking about like at least four people who were like just unknown, innocent strangers, unknown to a gunman, and that only happened. That did happen in 1966. I don't know if you've ever heard of. There was a guy named Charles Whitman. He climbed to the top of the University of Texas Tower in Austin. And he just started picking off people. That was in August of 66. And that was such a shock because nothing like that happened in the 60s. As bad as the riots got the next year, I mean, and all the and there was a lot of crime going on. Maybe not as bad as now. But you just never heard about these mass shootings. It just didn't happen. And as a matter of fact, I don't remember. You know, I didn't grow up with guns. Like I didn't even own a gun until I was in my 20s. You know, I got into shooting and hunting when I was in my early 20s. But when I was a kid, my parents, you know, they had no opinion about guns. There were no guns in the house. But I remember reading recently about back then in rural areas of the country, boys used to just take their bicycles to school with a .22 or a shotgun across the handlebars and just go hunting on the way home after school. And it was like nothing. It was just so common. People,
they had like gun racks at schools. Like you could show up and throw your gun up on the rack, and at the end of the day, pick it up and go home.
Yeah, either that or put them in a locker for the day. Yeah, it was just such a much more trusting atmosphere, and there was that. And then and it's very interesting when you think about it. When this is prior to the 68 Gun Control Act came along, which Johnson pushed. And I think that was after King and Robert Kennedy were assassinated. But my point is, you know, even before all these oppressive gun laws, it was a much safer country for people to own guns, even kids, young teenagers, you know. So, that's not to say that there wasn't crime going on. I mean, there was weird stuff going on. As a matter of fact, couple of weeks before this was another big thing in 66, I remember. Richard Speck, does that name ring a bell with you?
Who was it? Richard what?
Richard Speck. He went into a nurse's, a dormitory of a nursing school in Chicago.
Out of nowhere.
And you never heard of that. He stabbed, this was just before the Texas shooting, and he stabbed eight nurses to death. That was a big thing in 66. It was like, what the hell is going on with this world, you know? That was a big thing. That was in July of 66. I remember that very clearly. But again, there were no mass shootings. But as I said earlier, 67 was the year when things started getting a little weird. And that was in the summer of 67. That's when the country exploded in race riots. As a matter of fact, I think they were even worse than the George Floyd riots of 2020. And the whole country just went up and... almost all the big cities had riots. And I remember, you know, I was living in Williston Park. I even remember just down a block from me, like 4 miles, you had Williston Park, Mineola, Garden City, and then there was Hempstead, which I even think you're familiar with. Remember Hempstead when you were living there?
We've talked about Hempstead.
Yeah, we did talk about it. Very black town. And they were walking into stores, just like they're doing now. I don't think there was any violence, but they were just walking into stores, you know, and just taking merchandise, just walking out with their arms full of all kinds of merchandise, you know. And this was like 4 miles away from me, which was scary, you know. And you start wondering if it's going to spread right down the block from me, right down the block from them, you know. But nothing really happened. Well, I mean, nothing on Long Island really happened that was that bad. I later learned that there was other stuff. There were no really big riots on Long Island. But there was this kind of lawlessness, this kind of atmosphere where the blacks could do whatever they want. And there were, like I said, there were several towns, actually, I learned later, black towns where they just would walk into stores and walk out with stuff. But anyway.
And that sort of thing was happening all over the country during this time. I mean, of course, we see that even today. But back then, and this is a result of I think, I mean, you said it earlier, this was basically more or less like a communist Marxist inspired conspiracy to instigate these racial tensions, to create this sort of Reconstruction 2.0 in the South and systematically displace whites politically and like culturally. And they've been very, very successful.
And 67 was a very bad year, the summer of 67, especially in Detroit has never, especially the two worst hit cities were Detroit and Newark, New Jersey. And I've gone back, I've gone on YouTube and seen some of the newsreels. I remember seeing a YouTube clip of blacks shooting at cops from, you can see the gun, you can hear the gunfire, you can see the gun smoke. I mean, it was a war. It was a literal war. They were shooting at each other. I don't even think that happened in 2020. Maybe it did. I don't know. But, you know, my point was it was very bad. And then I had the feeling that, you know, things aren't right. And then, like I said, things started getting weird on my own. You know, the funny thing was the Beatles, I wanted to get into that. They were so huge back in the 60s. They were like in the vanguard of some, not only music, but I remember, I think it was 67, that's when they put out the Sgt. Pepper's album. And in my mind, you've heard that album, I'm sure,
oh,
right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I've always kind of liked the Beatles, honestly, but I recognize like the subversive nature of it now, obviously.
That was when they started getting weird too, you know, just the way they dressed for that album. And
compare that album to like their original albums from like the 50s. Their original albums were all about love and, you know, that
I don't think the 50s. I think I still remember going back to 64 again. Part of my reminiscences of the 60s. I remember the date. It was February 9th, 1964. And my parents, you know, I was 10 years old and I had, you know, me and my younger brother and two younger sisters. We went to my aunts and uncles to have dinner. And, you know, and then when the adults were talking around the table after dinner, those kids were watching television. And up comes the Ed Sullivan Show. And this was their debut in America. And I still remember, I'm sure you've seen clips of this. These women just, these teenage girls and young women screaming hysterically. I had never seen human behavior like that in my life. And at that point I had never even heard of the Beatles. A lot of kids my age did, but I didn't. I said, what the hell is this? You know, they came out, they did three songs, and all these girls and young women screaming. Have you ever seen that clip of the Ed Sullivan Show?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I just Googled it. I'm sorry. Yeah, the Beatles' first album was Please Please Me in 1963.
Right.
But, like, you compare that album to where, like, you know, from 63 to, like, 65, 66, 67, they went from Please Please Me to Rubber Soul was a little bit kind of getting a little weird. Revolver was weird. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was very weird. And then the Magical Mystery Tour. I mean, it just got like more and more like psychedelic and kind of like drugged out.
Yeah,
and like
that's
just
the word.
Yeah.
That's the word. And they were like I think it might be true that everybody kind of followed them in their wake. You know, that's a very interesting observation on your part because you weren't around then. But I felt exactly the same way. Psychedelic is the word. They started getting weird, you know, Strawberry Fields Forever.
Right. Which, I mean, again, it is kind of weird. I mean, honestly, like I said, I've always kind of liked the Beatles. But, yeah, you can kind of recognize it now, how they changed and how they were used. And I mean, there's all sorts of research about this. I mean, who was the guy that passed away maybe 10 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, that did all the research into like Laurel Canyon and how like a lot of the big Hollywood people and, you know, the music industry, they were like very much tied up with like the CIA and promoting this like counterculture, like Jim Morrison, for example, The Doors.
Yeah, he was weird.
And a lot of these groups, you look at like their original stuff and it's good. It's like very much more wholesome than,
you know,
what they later developed into, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that myself. Even The Doors, you know, Jim Morrison was definitely a strange duck. But, you know, I have a CD of The Doors. I listen to him sometimes.
I've always loved The Doors, yeah.
Yeah. You know, but I wanted to say that, you know, in the 60s, you know, before we did this, I was just to prepare for it. Yesterday I went on Wikipedia just to look up the top 100 hits of 66, 67, 68, and 69, because I just wanted to jot down and mention some of my favorite songs. There were so many of them. I mean, there was so much great music then. You know, the Beatles, a lot of the Beatles songs were very nice. You know, the Beach Boys, I mean, good real.
Oh, the Beach Boys were awesome, yeah.
Good, clean music, you know, I mean, really just great to listen to. I still listen to it. You know, and if you go on the comment boards of some of these or whatever websites, and you, I'm kind of like moved. I see people around my age, almost with, you know, that they would write about it, there's a tear in their eyes when they think they listen to those old songs of the '60s. It just brings back some really good memories, and it does for me too. And like you were saying, even the stuff like for example, the Mamas and the Papas, they were a little campy and they were a little weird, but they put out some really beautiful songs. And I said to myself, you know what? I can't shut. There's so many songs that just bring back memories from when I was a kid. And I really, really, even the ones that I really didn't care for that much, it was still good, clean, wholesome music, almost all of it, you know, compared to today. It's just such a different world. And
you know, and that's the thing about music. I mean, I kind of grew up listening to either like 90s country music. Like, I kind of grew up in the 90s. So, like, mm-hmm. country has always been one of my favorite genres. And mainstream country nowadays is much different, and I'm not a huge fan of it. There's, like, very few country artists that I even appreciate anymore. But, like, the 90s country, early 2000s country is still very good, in my opinion. And a lot of those artists are still very good, like Kenny Chesney and Alan Jackson and stuff. Although even some of them have put out some more subversive, very, like, overly sexual type songs mm-hmm. that is just, in my opinion, not appropriate and very much not in line with their original material. But anyways, like the 90s country, and then like I've always liked classic rock, like, you know, the classics. And still, even today, I think that music is superior to a lot of what comes out. Although there are a lot of good bands nowadays, they just, you know, you won't see them, you know, promoted the way these more subversive, degenerate, you know, singers and songwriters and entertainers are today. Like, the stuff is just overtly like satanic, like the rap music, the, you know, a lot of these female singers, even like Miley Cyrus and Taylor Swift. I mean, even they're doing like a lot of really subversive, disgusting
you know,
stuff these days.
It's funny you mentioned there was no rap music back in the 60s. As a matter of fact, some of the black singers back then, like the Supreme, Diana Ross and the
Motown.
Supreme,
is like the best music of best black music you'll ever encounter. Yeah.
Yeah, O.C. Smith. Ever hear that song "Little Green Apples"? Just to mention one song. It's a really
pretty
song.
God. I'm sure if I heard it, I'd recognize it. It doesn't sound familiar off the top of my head, but
Little Green Apples.
I still listen to a lot of that music. Mm-hmm. I'll still put on like a Motown, like Pandora station, or, you know, you can go on YouTube and pull up certain genres or whatever. And that's, to me, brilliant, lovely music.
Yeah, a lot of it. I spent a lot of time on YouTube listening to all that stuff back in the late 60s. You know, another thing I wanted to mention, you know, even with all the crazy stuff, you know, looking back on my childhood, it was really a good, stable time to grow up. I mean, I was in the Cub Scouts and the Boy Scouts. I played Little League, Babe Ruth baseball. You know, another thing I wanted to mention, I had a paper route. Yeah, I don't think anybody does that today.
There were kids my age when I was growing up that had a paper route. In fact, I was considering doing it myself, but I needed the neighborhood that I was in and like the route that it would have been, you needed a vehicle to do it. But no, there were still kids doing paper routes. I don't know if that, I doubt that. I very, very much doubt that's happening in most places nowadays.
Yeah, when I was like 12 and 13, like I think for about a year and a half, like my junior high years, I had a paper route. I had to get out there every day except Sunday. It was Newsday, you know, which of course I, such a horrible rag. Of course I didn't realize that back then, but, they didn't have a Sunday paper back then, so it was Monday to Saturday. It was a big responsibility. After school, I would just go down with my bike, and I had a basket in the front. I had about 35 papers to deliver, and I had to do that every day, 6 days a week, you know, for about a year and a half. And I'd have to collect money from the customers. What are we going to say?
Oh, no, what? It probably took you two, 3 hours to do the whole route?
I don't think it took – well, not that long, because, you know, the houses were pretty close together, maybe an hour and a half. But I had to do it every day. And I had to collect once a week. I had to collect. It was a nickel copy back then, so I had to collect 30 cents. Most people gave me a dime tip. And I had a little, you know, I still remember carrying the change in a little green bag in my basket, and I had a little book when if they weren't home to collect the money, I just, you know, keep a record of everything. You know, it wasn't, it was easy to do, and just that little responsibility and that little experience of having a job like that, I just don't see it today. I don't know.
No,
it's out your
no.
way. Are there any kids delivering papers these days?
That's a good question. I don't know. I would very much doubt it. I could be wrong about that, but I would kind of doubt it. You see kids working, but it's more like either in the food industry, you know, like a serving, you know, work, not serving at a restaurant, but working at a restaurant, or there's a big amusement park that they hire a lot of kids. Like, I think you have to be 14 to work there, and they have a lot of like younger kids working there. So, I mean, there still are places like that, but it's probably not as prevalent as it was back when, you know, when you were growing up, obviously.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a lot of little odd jobs, you know, and I used to go around my friends, collect bottles and cardboard and newspapers and bring them to a place that recycled, and we get paid for it. And I don't know. It just seems, it was just a different world back then. You know, and of course, racially, it was not, even though, you know, the immigration bill was passed in 65. I mean, there was nothing. I don't remember a single Indian. I mean, like an Asian Indian. I don't remember one. I don't remember any. No Spanish-speaking people from the Central American countries. Not one. I don't remember any of that. Just a few Chinese, very, very few, and they were like all in the laundry or the takeout restaurant business. It was either white or black, and there was a small Puerto Rican population in New York City, you know, and of course, you know, in the Southwest, I'm sure there was a lot of Mexicans, but it was a white country back then too.
Yeah. That's one thing that I wanted to bring up. There's actually two things I wanted to bring up, and that was one of them, the 1965 Immigration Act, which, you know, I've talked about pretty extensively. Dr. Kevin McDonald has written about it extensively, how it was, you know, the culmination of a major Jewish lobbying campaign. And I mean, I just, you know, you Google 1965 Immigration Act, and the first thing that pops up about it is the 1965 Immigration Act ended the racist quota system that favored Europeans and restricted Asians and Africans, basically opening up the border to the third world, which is what critics of the Great Replacement and critics of massive non-white immigration have always pointed out, and yet they're demonized as, you know, racist. Of course, that's what it says right here when you Google it. It's a racist idea to want to maintain the traditional demographic in this country. But I think, I mean, although this sort of like got the ball rolling, I don't think you saw like huge numbers of third worlders make big impacts until later, like the 80s, 90s. Yeah.
No. No, you're totally right about it. It didn't kick in. I mean, I don't remember exactly when I first started noticing a shift in the racial population. I don't know, maybe the 80s. I don't know, but it certainly didn't happening in the 60s. You know, even with all the degeneracy going on and all the other bad stuff, like I said, the race riots, and it was just a good time to grow up. And you know, another thing, there was a lot of little things. This might sound very, very minor, but I don't remember seeing a single woman with a tattoo back then. It just didn't happen, or piercings. I mean, you know, nowadays, God, I mean, you know, I've gone into some rural, especially in Northeast Pennsylvania. I mean, more than half the women. You know, I was there in the summertime 2 years ago, and just driving around and stopping here and there. And so many women have heavily scrawled tattoos. I'm not talking about one or two discreet tattoos. I mean, very heavily tattooed. And it was just, you know, if I were to come, if I had gone to a remote tropical island back in 65 and come back, you know, like 50 years later, I just wouldn't believe what the things I was seeing.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Like being on a different planet.
Oh, it's, know, yeah, absolutely.
One
it's,
of the little things.
Yeah, yeah, it's hard to encounter anybody these days that doesn't have a tattoo. I don't have a tattoo. I've never gotten a tattoo, and I never will.
No.
But I'm probably in the minority at this point. I mean, most people, I don't know what the statistics are, but I would bet that it's at least close, if not over 50% of people have tattoos in America now.
I made a mental note when I was in Pennsylvania. I would say roughly 70% of men and women had tattoos. You know, it was the summertime, so people were wearing shorts. And, you know, some of them had them on their arms, some on their legs, some on both. You know, and again, I'm not talking about one little tiny tattoo, you know, a little rose or something on your shoulder. I mean,
like a whole sleeve tattoo. Well, and that kind of ties in. We're gonna have to talk much more about the counterculture of the 1960s and the Vietnam War. We didn't even really get into the Vietnam War.
We didn't get into that. No, of course.
Yeah,
that's another creation
of
Johnson.
But that's okay. I mean, we've got a lot of material to kind of go through. One thing I did want to mention, though, and I'm only bringing it up because of the recent movie about Barbie, and Barbie really became popularized in the 1960s. I think the company was founded in 59.
I remember Barbie dolls, yeah.
And believe it or not, I mean, of course, it's probably not going to surprise you, but the woman that founded Barbie is a woman named Ruth Handler, who's a Jew. And the movie Barbie is kind of gets into her background, and like, it's a very, very subversive movie, in my opinion. It's like teaching little girls and just, you know, I guess just girls in general, that being a mother is like oppressive, and it's like, you know, you're better than that. You don't have to be a mom. You can be a career woman and make money. And it's very like feminist. In fact, the opening scene of the movie is like straight from the mind of Satan. It's like a group of little girls. Spoiler alert for anybody that hasn't seen the movie. It's probably not even worth your time. But anyways, the opening scene is like little girls playing with dolls and like, you know, being mommies and feeding the doll and taking care of it and, you know, being that sort of motherly figure. And then, you know, they have this transformation where they like rebel from this and they like start like destroying the babies. Like they're smashing the baby dolls into like a rock. It's very, very dark and evil. And that's kind of, I mean, that's really like a big part of, I mean, basically like this whole Barbie phenomenon had a huge impact on women. Maybe not even on, like maybe it wasn't even meant to be like in a straightforward way. It was very much more so like subliminally. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, I don't know. Back in the 60s, you know, I certainly remember Barbie dolls. Maybe my younger sisters play with them. I don't remember really, but I think it was Barbie and Ken, and they were pretty normal. Back in the 60s anyway. I mean, it was nothing subversive about it. I heard about that movie, by the way, which by the way has been banned in a lot of Islamic countries for being subversive, as you said.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing.
I'll tell you what it is.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, back. That's another thing. You brought the word feminism. I didn't, you know, the whole woman's lib movement, you know, again, it was happening, but I wasn't aware of it. It wasn't like in your face. I mean, like in the early 70s, that's when, feminism really started, getting really kind of out of control. And also the gay liberation movement. Of course, as you know, they had the Stonewall. They say the whole thing started in June of 69 when the cops raided the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village. That kind of kicked off the gay liberation movement. But again, that stuff, you didn't hear much about queers back then. I mean, I don't, you can make jokes about them, and it was they just kept a very low profile. They were in the closet. But again, I didn't really know about.
Yep.
I mean, I knew there was such a thing as homosexuality, but it was nothing like it is today. I mean, it's just gotten worse and worse over the decades to the point now. You know, all this transgender, all this horrible stuff that, there's been some pushback, which is good, but not enough. So,
well, you know what? We're going to have to pick up on this topic in the next conversation. I actually wrote an article. When was this? Let me see. This was back in 2019. It's a blog post on my website that you can find, and it's all about how Jews played a key role in the whole gay rights movement. And they will openly tell you this in their own newspapers. In this article that I wrote, I quote extensively from an article published by the Times of Israel, basically documenting how many of these very radical LGBTQ+ activists that played a key role in sort of promoting and pushing this gay rights movement were Jews. And they were not only were they Jews, they were very like consciously aware of their Jewish identity and were motivated by their Jewishness. So And I think that sort of mindset applies to a lot of these very subversive, anti-Christian, anti-white cultural movements and political movements that we saw throughout the 60s, and that mm-hmm. we're still sort of dealing with today. I mean, now we got little kids literally like chopping off their private parts and saying
they're crazy.
I mean, it's, can you imagine like you can't make this stuff up. It's insane.
Even five years ago, I couldn't. As bad as things were 5 years ago, and you know, as much as I sensed that things were really going downhill, I mean, these sex change operations. And of course, there were a few. You know, I think what was the first one? That tennis player, Renee something or other, back in the 70s. She was the first one to do it. But it was such a one-off thing. You know, it was so weird that nobody really paid attention. But now it's. Now it's front and center all the time. Yeah, it's just, we're living in completely crazy times. You know, that's the whole point I've been trying to make. As crazy as the 60s were, you know, and they were crazy in a lot of ways, especially the second half of the decade when they started becoming aware of this stuff. I mean, it's nothing like it is today, you know? So
yeah. Well, John, I'll tell you what, man, this has been a great conversation, as I knew it would be. It always is. Yeah. No, and hang on to your notes. I've got some notes jotted down myself, and we'll pick up. You know,
we didn't even get into the Vietnam War at all.
I know.
That was the whole point. That was why.
I know. Well, you know what, though? Definitely. Well, and honestly, like, there's even more that could be said about the 60s. I mean, that we haven't even gotten into. So, I mean, we could take this any number of ways. I say we just pick up and just kind of continue this conversation next time. Yeah.
Yeah, so, you jot down your own notes because I love talking about that decade. So if there's anything on your mind that I hadn't thought about, let's bring it up and we'll do it again that way. So
okay, awesome. Thanks, John. I appreciate it, guys. Check out endtheshots.com and pick up a copy of John's book, "Will Vaccines Be the End of Us?" If you have not already. And yeah, buddy, take care, man. I'll be in touch and we'll do this. Hopefully sooner rather than later. I know it's been a couple months, but I'd like to get kind of back into a more regular routine. But you know how things go with crazy schedules and stuff. So, okay, John, I'll send you a link when this is up. Yep, and take care, man. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, take care now.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.